From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Later this hour on The Exchange, we plug back into the Granite State's electricity debate and why energy costs here are so high. It's a question the Public Utilities Commission is now investigating, and we'll find out more. But first, the town of Pittsfield, New Hampshire, is getting some favorable national attention for its experiment in what's called student-centered learning. It's an approach described as the opposite of chalk and talk, where the teacher holds center court, lecturing at the blackboard. Instead, teachers act more as coaches, helping students learn the material in a variety of ways. While this concept has been around in private settings like Montessori schools for some time, it's enjoying newfound popularity in public schools. Here in New Hampshire, Pittsfield's efforts caught the attention of Emily Richmond, a longtime reporter and public editor of the Education Writers Association. Last fall, she began a series of articles all focused on this question: what happens when students control their own education? We'll find out this hour as we talk with Emily Richmond, and let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Emily Richmond joins us from Michigan. Emily, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, give us your best description of student-centered learning.
Student-centered learning is when kids are given a choice of how and when they learn. This is based on the idea that kids do better when they can see a direct connection between what they're being asked to learn in the classroom and their own interests and real-world experiences.
And what's the big goal?
The primary goal, obviously, is college and career readiness, but you also want to create kids who are going to be engaged and excited about learning and see it as a valuable thing on its own, as opposed to just a means to an end, such as a high school diploma or even getting a college degree, but to turn them into the kind of thinkers and creative thinkers where learning is a pleasure. And the idea is to build those kinds of relationships in the classroom where instead of having a teacher standing up what they used to call the sage on a stage, they have them working as collaborators, and it's a collaborative effort between the teacher and the student.
Well, okay, so here's the big question, and I love the title of one of your articles. That big question: what happens when students control their own education? So what did you see happening in Pittsfield?
Well, a big misconception about student-centered learning is that it's, I jokingly call it, you know, free-range education.
Where
right, you're turning
chaos.
You're turning kids out into the pasture and saying, there's some books out there, there's some life experiences, good luck. It's really much more structured than that. So when we talk about students controlling their education, it has to be within a certain prescribed framework. So, for example, it has to have high, rigorous expectations and standards. There are a lot of words being tossed around that would fit underneath a student-centered learning umbrella, if you will, things like personalized learning, student-teacher partnerships, collaborative learning, or even competency-based education where kids can advance at their own pace based on demonstrated knowledge versus a certain number of seat time hours. But what you find is when students are given choices, they often make really interesting ones. And they, because they have ownership or they've bought into it, they're more engaged and more excited about what they're doing. And the toughest thing, I think, for teachers is to figure out what is going to flip that switch for each individual kid. So you have to have a flexible learning environment where for one kid, that learning experience might be actually reading a bunch of books and writing a bunch of reports. But for another, it might be going out and having a workplace experience, coming back, writing an academic paper about that experience, and having that tap into what they've learned in a very personal way. And a classroom has to be flexible for different kinds of learners.
Well, sure. And a little bit later in the hour, we'll talk to one of the English teachers that you interviewed extensively in your series, Emily, a little bit more detail from her on how she does it. I also want to invite our listeners again to join us. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Emily Richmond is with us, public editor for the Education Writers Association. She's writing a four-part series about student-centered learning in Pittsfield, New Hampshire. The Hechinger Report has underwritten these articles in partnership with The Atlantic. That's where you can read them. You can check them out on our website, too, nhpr.org/exchange. We're talking about student-centered learning and hearing a little bit more from Emily about how it works, especially as how it's been rolling out in Pittsfield. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Now, Emily, I know some people are listening and saying, you know, this has been going on for a long time. My kid went to a Montessori school or another type of different educational environment, and this is the standard there. So it's not entirely new.
It's definitely not new. And as you pointed out correctly, it does date back quite a bit. You can find roots of this as far back as John Dewey in the early 20th century, Maria Montessori. A psychologist named Carl Rogers was a big proponent of student-centered learning. And it's also fair to argue that these things go in cycles, that we've somehow circled back to something that was working before. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not working, simply because it's not new. It may have just been something that we gave up on. And, you know, I think it's a frustration for educators and parents, and also for people who follow education, people like education journalists, that there's not a lot of patience to let these things take root. And I do think that's one thing that's interesting about the Pittsfield experiment, is because of the substantial financial support they're getting in terms of federal and private grants, they have the time to say, we're going to make this really big investment and also give it time to take root.
Why did Pittsfield decide to jump into this, in addition to, you know, the obvious incentive of money?
Well, you know, Pittsfield was rated one of the state's lowest performing high schools dating back to about 2009, when the state was putting in for its school improvement grants from the federal government. So they got a planning grant from the feds to say, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to reimagine what our kids want to learn? And they set up a committee called Pittsfield Listens, in which they literally went out into the community and started talking to people, saying, what is it that you want in your school system? And to give them credit, they got some pretty harsh criticism, but also a lot of positive feedback and community engagement. And through those conversations, they decided that student-centered learning was the tack they were going to take. And with that, they signed on to a partnership, a consortium of 13 New England schools, which are being funded by the Nellie Mae Education Foundation. They're based in Quincy, Massachusetts, with a partnering grant from the Rural Schools Partnership, and then, of course, the money from the Fed. So all of those schools have said personalized instruction, collaborative learning, personalized learning, that's the way that we want to go. So they're all, in a sense, there's some synergy there. They're working together, trying out these ideas. And for Pittsfield, it seems to be making a difference.
What did it mean for teachers there, all of a sudden being told that, you know, students are now in charge of their own learning? How do they feel about that?
You know, John Freeman, the superintendent of Pittsfield, to his credit, was very candid with me. He said it was not for everyone, and they found that out pretty early on in the process. They had some significant staff turnover. More than half of the teachers left and moved on to other positions, not just because of the student-centered learning, although for some of them that was the factor. And it was a question of, you know, you have to have the teachers really excited about this. They also tried something different, which is they got rid of the traditional principal position and put in two deans. So they have a dean of instruction who essentially functions as a coach to work directly with the teachers, and then they have a second dean who's responsible for more of the management of the building. And the first two people who were in those positions, that didn't work either. It's not an easy transition, and you have to be prepared for a very different kind of collaborative experience. And I think, you know, Jenny Wellington can certainly speak to that, but what I found was so interesting is there's a lot more crossover opportunities to show students that what you learn in biology doesn't stop in biology class. What you learn in English doesn't stop in English class. One example that Jenny gave me that I thought was just a really nice way to show people how student-centered learning can work is the kids are studying stem cells in biology class, but they have to write a persuasive essay for Jenny's class about whether or not you should be using human stem cells in research. And then that paper has to be graded by both the biology teacher as well as their English teacher.
Yeah, again, Jenny Wellington, high school English teacher in Pittsfield, who will be joining us in another minute or two. You know, I wanted to ask you about something you said earlier, that, again, this whole concept of student-centered learning, you know, giving kids a choice of how and when they learn, you said it's not new, gave us a lot of historical examples. But then you said we, as a society, kind of gave up on this. Why did we give up on this?
Well, one reason we gave up on it, in my understanding, and granted I'm not an education historian, although I'd certainly love to be someday, the efficiency issue became too huge. So, you know, at the turn of the century, high school was not for everyone, and then suddenly you had the Great Depression, and kids were not going to work right after eighth grade. They had nowhere to go. You had a massive influx of kids coming into public high schools, and the high schools literally became the kind of factories that, you know, U.S. Secretary of Arne Duncan has decried, in which it was all about efficiency. How do you move as many kids through the system as quickly and efficiently as possible? How do you squeeze the most out of every teacher? And I don't necessarily know that there was a decision made to stop what anyone might have called student-centered learning, or even how pervasive that was in the public school system. But certainly what we have now is much more focused on building efficiency, on getting as many kids through a school as cheaply as we can. And in part, that's because so much has been cut from public school funding nationally, especially since the recession. So schools have a lot less money and a lot less time to focus on individual children.
Wow, that's really interesting. So this way is less efficient, more expensive.
Well, I don't know if it's less efficient, because efficiency, it depends on how you define it. Is it less efficient if you have kids who are more engaged and have better life outcomes? In the long run, it's better for a society, I would say, to have high school graduates who don't just get a piece of paper, but actually gain some kind of deeper thinking, deeper learning skills that they can translate into better life outcomes long after high school. In terms of being expensive, it takes money and resources. And one of the really big questions we have about student-centered learning, as I mentioned in my latest piece, is whether you can take something like this, which is being done at a tiny rural school, and implement it in a large urban high school setting. There are some great examples of student-centered learning happening in other places. Last week, my organization had our national seminar in Chicago, and we brought in some educators and students doing student-centered learning in other places, and it's happening in places like Revere High School, a large public open enrollment high school in Massachusetts. And it can be done, but it takes, again, a concerted effort. It takes a certain kind of mindset. You can't just pull out one piece of it and call it student-centered learning. You know, for example, to say to a kid, okay, we're going to let you choose what you want to learn, but you're going to have to do it on a library computer and only between the hours of 1 and 3 p.m. That's not student-centered learning.
All right. Coming up, we'll learn a little bit more about how this works, what some of the logistical issues with it are. We'll also talk to Jenny Wellington. She's a high school English teacher in Pittsfield who is actively using student-centered learning. We'll take your questions and comments too. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And again, we're taking your comments and questions. 1-800-892-6477. More on student-centered learning on The Exchange in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at a concept called student-centered learning as it's been playing out in Pittsfield, New Hampshire schools. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions and comments. Our guest is Emily Richmond, public editor for the Education Writers Association. She's writing a four-part series about student-centered learning in Pittsfield for the Hechinger Report in partnership with The Atlantic Magazine. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Joining us now on the phone is Jenny Wellington, high school English teacher in Pittsfield. She's featured in Emily's reports. And Jenny, welcome to you too.
Hi, thank you.
Well, Emily's been explaining to us what student-centered learning is. What I'd like to get from you, Jenny, if I could please, is just examples of how you do this. So if you could just give us an example of a standard content area that any high schooler might be expected to know, English, algebra, history, whatever, and how you apply student-centered learning to that.
Well, I'll use English since that's my subject. So we do a unit on 1920-1930 literature, and I combine with the U.S. history teacher. And for that unit, we have students choose a topic, and they have to be able to connect political, social, factors for that topic and how it influenced their topic. And the students can choose anything. They can do Al Capone, they can do flappers, and they research this and then they present a report both for the U.S. history teacher and for me.
So the choice there isn't you can do a report or not. The choice is you decide what to report on.
Yeah, because I'm an English teacher, I do focus a lot on the writing piece.
Mm-hmm.
But I offer my students lots of choice in terms of the topic that they choose.
That's interesting. Okay, because as Emily said earlier, people hear student-centered learning and they think it's the Wild West, but you're saying not really.
No, you have to give some parameters. Otherwise, it would be total chaos. I might give parameter around the topic, or I might give parameter around the outcome. So they don't always have to write an issue or an essay. They might be able to do a presentation as well.
Where do you struggle with this, Jenny? Are there times when you just, you have to take over and do it the old-fashioned way?
I think the struggle comes with the organization piece. I have 50 students, and they're all studying something different. So when I, come up and talk to them and conference with them during class, sometimes I have to say, what is your topic again? It's hard to remember what they're all doing, but that is kind of, that's easier to manage. Pacing is a challenge where a student might get through something really quickly and, the class isn't quite ready to move on yet to the next thing. So, trying to figure out how can I keep supporting that student and keep them engaged and give them more material to challenge them.
You said you have 50, 5-0, Jenny?
Roughly, yeah, between my 11th and 12th graders.
Okay, so roughly 25 kids per class.
Yeah, more or less.
Do you break kids up into groups and have them do group projects? I've read that this is a big part of student-centered learning. I don't know how much you use that.
Yeah, we do group work. My 11th graders just finished a group project on a transcendentalist writer. My seniors are doing a group project around the play Our Town right now. So group projects are really, really great way to engage students.
I've read also, and I got some of this from Emily's writing too, that sometimes kids are a little wary of group projects because, we've all heard stories about I was in a group, me and this other kid were the only ones that did any work. Everybody else was sitting back, filing their fingernails.
Yep, that is definitely an issue. The way that I combat that is by, at the beginning of the group project, they have to lay out what their roles and responsibilities are. We have to do check-ins. And then at the end of the project, based on their roles and responsibilities, they evaluate themselves. We talk as a group, so the group talks together and decides, how they think they did and are evaluated based on the criteria that they set forth.
Interesting. I wonder what you think about that, Emily. We've all heard, again, the stories about, group work. One person pulls the weight, two people pull the weight, and the others kind of sit back and goof off.
I talked to a student about that, actually at a student-centered learning school in Chicago at Cesar Chavez Academy, and she actually told me, she loves the group work because it forces her to respond to those kinds of situations. I mean, let's be honest, we're not all going to get to go out into the world into jobs where we get to set our own pace or work independently. We are going to have to work with other people. And for kids going on to college, there is going to be group work as well. So I think it's never too early to start exposing kids to ways to sort of negotiate those relationships. And Jenny told me one great story about student conversations about how she's able to take kids and ask them to step back a little bit in conversations if she feels that they're dominating too much, or ask them to be mindful about kids in the class who are quieter. And sometimes she'll sit kids who are quieter with kids who are more talkative to sort of change the dynamic a little bit. And I think that kind of awareness on the part of a teacher like Jenny is really one of the ways that this works. Again, you can't just set kids off in a room and tell them to work in a group and hope for the best. You've got to have an adult presence. You've got to have somebody who's mindful of how to set up those relationships to give kids the best chance to succeed.
Yeah, that was a question that I had, Jenny, about, in any group, at work or in school, there are people who speak up and people who hang back, and you don't want certain kids dominating discussions or decisions.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest components of student-centered learning is getting the kids to understand who they are as learners and their awareness, that self-awareness of what their role is in the classroom and in the work. So very often, we know this. The students know, I'm a chatty person. I know I dominate the conversation. Or they know I'm a visual learner, or I need to hear this, I need to hear the text on a tape first before I read it. And I think that idea is, and that's making people and making, that lifelong learner and making that person somebody who is aware of who they are in a workplace environment as well.
All right, let's take some calls, both of you. Again, the number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Student-centered learning is the topic this hour. We're learning more about how it's been playing out in Pittsfield New Hampshire, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Michelle's calling us from Hooksett. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I am a parent at Polaris Charter School in Manchester, which is a elementary charter, and they use a student-centered learning approach, project-based learning approach, and I've really seen the power of that in the students at that school, and am now taking that with a group of parents to create a follow to Polaris in a middle school, high school format.
Wow. So give us an example of that power you talk about, Michelle. That's interesting.
Well, I, in addition to being a parent, am lucky enough to work in the school and see students that one of the things that Polaris does phenomenally well is allow students to learn at their own pace and according to their own learning style. So we have students who function well beyond their grade level in learning, working with students who may struggle in that same topic area, but they're working together and learning from each other, and they truly love what they're doing. Students are excited to come back to school. Sometimes they actually don't want to go out on vacations because they're really engaged in what they're doing.
Wow, that's the first time I've heard that. Thanks a lot for calling in, Michelle. I really appreciate it. What do you think about this, Emily Richmond?
I think that's great to hear. And, you know, also it's great to hear from a parent at an elementary school level because we've been talking about high school primarily. And I do think that there are concerns about doing it in younger grades, again, whether kids are ready for that kind of an experience. And it sounds like they really are in that kind of supportive school setting.
You know, I have a very practical question for you, Jenny, on this issue of pacing that you raised and that our caller raises. There is a concern that since the teacher isn't delivering all the material all at once to all the kids at the same time, that some kids might miss content, especially if the class is, you know, breaking up in groups or doing different projects here and there. How do you get around that, Jenny?
Well, I think it actually allows for not to miss content, but you can actually add more content that way. You can hit kids where they're at. You know, if a kid's moving too quickly, or not too quickly, but if a kid's moving quickly, you can say, great, well, I think you should read this now, and maybe read this as well, you know, then pull in more resources for them. So it doesn't actually hold them back. It actually allows you to, like, push them further.
What about the idea that Michelle talked about, that kids who are moving more quickly enjoy their role helping kids who aren't moving along as quickly? If a kid doesn't want to do that, doesn't feel like being the sort of junior teacher, would you put him or her in that role? Because some kids like to do that and some kids don't.
I might encourage them, but, you know, I'm not going to force a student if they're uncomfortable in that role. I might start, you know, with a, maybe the kid knows somebody and is comfortable working with a friend, and maybe we start there. But, ultimately, that we're all teachers. So you'd hope that eventually the students would find empowerment in that.
Well, Michelle, thanks again for the call. And again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email, exchange@nhpr.org. Both of you, here's an email that came in from Alice, who says, it sounds like each student would need 3 teachers, or each class would need 10. And also, people should not have to manage that form of education for the salary teachers get. Alice, thanks for the comments. I want to hear from both of you, but Emily, how about you first, that, you know, each student is going to need 3 teachers, I mean, or each class would need 10, that this takes a lot of resources.
It does take a lot of resources, and again, it's an investment, and you have to look at the short term versus the long term, and that's a difficult case to make for a public school system that may already be looking at financial worries, to say, look, the money that you're putting in at the front end now is money you're not going to have to pay out later. I mean, we know that the outcomes for students who do well in high school and go on to college, their lifetime outcomes are much better, but it's hard to say to a high school system, that's your responsibility and that's what you should be thinking about. You know, we ask a lot of schools today, and it used to be that we just sort of judged a high school on how many kids earned that diploma and then what happens to them after that really didn't matter for the school's own ratings. But now we're saying to them, we're expecting you to produce students who are contributive members of society, and we're going to ask you to track them and keep tabs on them. And to do that, schools need to be spending more.
And Emily, I think you wrote that Pittsfield is looking at, you know, not only graduation, but 7 years out from high school, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a perspective that a lot of people have these days. And, you know, in a lot of ways it's reasonable, but at the same time, if you're going to ask schools to be in a way responsible for those kinds of outcomes, then you have to be prepared to rethink what the high school experience is. And that's a conversation that's happening nationally. And I want to make it very clear that I don't think anybody who is enthusiastic about student-centered learning would call it a silver bullet or the right program for every student at every high school. I think it is a very specialized kind of program and a specialized way of learning, and in the right setting, it seems to be having great benefits. But certainly there's a lot of great reform happening at other schools across the country that are taking a different tack. It's really about getting the conversation going in the community with the educators, with the parents, involving the students, and saying, what is it that you think you need to achieve, and how can the school support you?
Well, and to Alice's second point, Jenny Wellington, she says people should not have to manage that form of education for the salary teachers get. Now, I'm not going to ask you to complain or be happy about your salary on the air, but I do wonder about her point. You know, is this a lot to manage for you? Is it more to manage than under a traditional model?
Well, I would agree with Emily that on the short term, there's some organizational challenges that go into it and some teaching strategies and pedagogy that you need to master. But in the long run, it's so much more fun because the students are more engaged.
Fun.
So whereas like, you know, the stand and deliver teacher, I get that Ferris Bueller movie image where, you know, trying to engage the students.
Right, they're all falling asleep, yeah.
You're right, but this way, you know, students are coming up to you going, you know, asking you questions and saying, you know, where can I go to find this information, or I have this great idea for a topic, you know, so they're more engaged, so there's less work on my part in trying to, like, pull them into the material.
Okay, so on that question of engagement, I do want to ask both of you about a big, big concern in education in general these days and how it relates to this idea of student-centered learning. And Emily, to you first, that's motivation. How does student-centered learning work when a student really isn't motivated? He or she could care less.
You know, I talked to a really bright professor from USC about that, Daphne Oyserman, who's written a book on student motivation. And what she said to me is that you have to get kids to understand that the future is not a very far away concept, that it's actually now, and that what they do now will have long-term repercussions for them. And that's a very difficult thing to tap into, and kids are motivated in different ways. You read about everything from outright bribery, paying kids for perfect attendance or turning in their homework. And the studies have found that that has no long-term benefits for kids. The kids who are bribed to show up every day in attendance in school are not going to have better long-term outcomes. Somehow, you have to find a way to tap in to kids' innate creativity and curiosity. And I think that gets squeezed out of kids. Very little kids, there's nothing they love better than a game of peekaboo, a game of surprise. And then suddenly, as we get older, it gets squeezed out of us. So I wish that there was a magic answer to say, this is how you tap into a kid's motivation. I'm sure Jenny, being in the classroom every day with kids, can answer this much better than I. But I think the more that you try and the more you give kids different avenues to explore, you have to hope that something clicks. So instead of just offering one way of learning, and if that doesn't do it, saying, I'm sorry, we tried, you're giving kids more avenues. You're giving them a chance to explore.
So at least if you have four choices, Emily, there's more chance that a kid might be at least moderately excited about one of those four choices.
That's right. I mean, I do reporters' math, and reporters are terrible at math, but certainly the odds seem higher of kids tapping into something if you give them four choices than if you just give them one.
All right. What do you think about that, Jenny Wellington?
I would say that my answer is personalization. If you can make the topic personalized for the students, then they're going to be more motivated. When we studied like Thoreau and Transcendentalists and Emerson, you know, my question was, what can you learn from these people to make yourselves greater and to make your lives better and bigger? And those answers were very personal and very touching, you know, to read from students that here they're engaging with this 19th century literature in a way that they can use in their life.
All right, let's take another call, both of you. Sam's calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Sam. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm actually a math education researcher, and I research this at the undergraduate level as opposed to the K-12 level.
Sure.
And one of the issues that we have trouble with trying to get, I do math education research, but trying to get math teachers to implement this, what we call inquiry-based learning, which is very similar to the student-centered learning that you're talking about, is that teachers are worried about coverage, so sort of similar to the efficiency issue you talked about earlier, and that, you know, that there are classes where they say, oh, we need to cover these 15 topics, and if we have the students lead this and we have the students dive deeper into these topics, we're never going to cover 15 topics. We're only going to be able to cover, say, 9.
Yeah.
And there's some current research that has shown that was just published by a researcher named Larson from University of Colorado, that students who were in this inquiry class that covered fewer topics but covered them deeper and in a way that they found more interesting versus a class that covered more topics, when they went into the same next class and were in the class together, that the students in the inquiry class performed as well or better.
Okay. Sam, thanks a lot for calling. Emily, what do you think?
You know, certainly at the college level, where we're talking about competency-based education gaining in popularity, I mean, definitely you can do math and have it be student-centered. The conference I talked about in Chicago, one of the teachers from Cesar Chavez Academy is actually an eighth-grade math teacher. And what she's figured out is kids have different ways of solving problems, and she has to give them opportunities to do that. But he's absolutely right about the question of coverage. I mean, in New Hampshire right now, you've got the Common Core. You've got an expectation for students to reach a certain standard and level of proficiency, and teachers have a lot to cover. And I think some of it probably is a learning curve. As teachers get better at it, so will the students. But certainly, again, this we go back to the question of, is this free-range education? It's not. There have to be very high expectations. At Pittsfield, there's a matrix for what they expect kids to know, and the teachers are constantly checking what they do against it make sure they're not getting off track.
Well, Emily Richmond, Jenny Wellington, thank you so much. Interesting stuff. Thanks for being
thank
with
you.
Us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Laura.
Again, talking about student-centered learning on the exchange. And coming up, we will be looking at why New Hampshire and New England have among the nation's highest energy prices. Stay with us.